Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Dr. Michael Shermer this entire hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Michael Shermer. We'll take your phone calls. Michael, so what is the Shermer's last law?
Oh, that any sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial is indistinguishable from God. So basically, well, it's inspired by Arthur C. Clarke's third law that any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. If you know what the technology is, then it's no longer magic. Like the guy with the computer chip in his brain who's paralyzed, but he can operate his computer by just thinking thoughts, and it moves the cursor across the screen. He can check email, play video games, that kind of thing. If you don't know about the chip in his brain, that looks like telekinesis because he's moving objects just with his thoughts. But if you know about the chip in the brain, then it's just cool technology. Well, from my analogy before when we were talking about extraterrestrial intelligences, if they were smarter, they wouldn't have to be much smarter than us to be able to create life, because we can almost do it. So if they're, you know, 50,000 years or 500,000 years ahead of us, just think of the things they'll be able to do. And how would that, if you didn't know their technology, we would call them gods. But if we knew how they did it, well, then they'd just be advanced extraterrestrials. So that's Shermer's last law.
Indeed.
And it's the last law because I don't believe in naming laws after yourself.
Let's go to the phones. Jeremy in Los Angeles, first-time caller. Go ahead, Jeremy. You're up with us.
Thank you very much.
Sure thing.
I just wanted to bring up the idea in talking about things like the 9/11 conspiracy and other incidents of apparent terrorism sponsored by the state, that there's a very big difference between nature and governments that are run by human beings, and that nature doesn't intentionally deceive. It's complicated, and it's hard to find out the theories that will explain it. But governments and some of the people that run governments, historically, their tendency is to deceive. And especially when you get into the modern era and you have intelligence agencies that have entirely secret, covert operations programs that are predicated on deception, then just like Paul Craig Roberts, the assistant treasury to of the Treasury under the Reagan Department said, if 9/11 was not a covert operation or a staged event of some sort, it would be the first time in the modern history of the United States that we went to war without an event like that.
Well, it was. It was staged and orchestrated by Al-Qaeda, which is, we're not used to thinking of diffuse organizations like that as a kind of a nation state, but it really is in its own way a collective body without borders. And clearly just as effective and dangerous, and in many ways probably more capable of pulling off something like this because they're harder to see and find. Like my example of Lee Harvey Oswald, it's harder to see because he's a nobody. The nobody's hard to find. It's the big targets that are easy to find.
Do you deal with the amazing Randy anymore, who won't come on?
I do, yeah, sure. Of course, I talk to Randy all the time. He's doing well. He's well into his 80s now, and, you know, like anybody in their 80s has some health issues, but he's still hanging in there. And it was Randy who actually said something like what your caller just said, that humans intentionally deceive, whereas nature does not. And that's why psychologists tend to fall for so-called psychics who are actually just doing magic tricks. The psychologists don't know what the magic tricks are, and they don't think of their subjects like rats or pigeons or whatever as intentionally deceitful. They may be hard to understand, but they're not intentionally lying, whereas people do. And so that was an important lesson I learned from Randy, because when I was in graduate school in psychology in the 1970s, Thelma Moss had her paranormal lab at UCLA, and mm-hmm. Uri Geller was bending spoons, and he was being tested by these professional experimental psychologists who, that's what I wanted to be, and they're smarter than me. And so I figured, well, if they think there's something to this, maybe there's something to it. And then I remember seeing Randy on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, where he was able to do everything Geller could do with tricks. And, you know, he didn't explain how the tricks were done, but he said, these are magic tricks. And if Geller's using psychic power, he's doing it the hard way. you know, which is kind of funny, but there's a lesson in there. It's like I remember watching that going, oh, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe these psychologists can be fooled, and of course they can. No problem by a good magician.
West Hartford, Connecticut. It's you, Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, hi, George. Hi. Hi, Dr. Michael Shermer. It's an honor and a pleasure to talk with you.
Okay.
Let me say that I'm an amateur astronomer myself, and I am an atheist, a member of American Atheists and the Council for Secular Humanism, and I have the magazine Free Inquiry, but I must say I don't have your magazine Skeptic, which I should get.
Okay, well, any Barnes & Noble or Borders will carry it in your neighborhood.
Okay. I wanted to say that... first of all, I've been an atheist since 1970 when I was age 20. I was very scientific-minded before that time. My point is, you mentioned an incident regarding, I think, a relative and what happened and trying to pray and how that helped you, at least from that point on, in addition to knowledge, in addition to your studies, become an atheist. With me, one of the main things was 1970 when I was age 20, Apollo 13. My point is, I was with a group of people watching the Apollo 13 mission, and someone said, "That's a miracle. God save the astronauts." Well, you mean the three astronauts themselves, plus the mission control, plus the engineers behind mission control, plus the 400,000 technicians behind the engineers had nothing to do with it. I'm like, of course, NASA did it themselves. And my second point along with that, to show that humans did that, not a so-called God, is what about Challenger and Columbia? God didn't like the space shuttle, so 14 astronauts died in two shuttle missions, but God loved Apollo. You see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, you point out the opposite side of the prayer or the God's miracle, like in 9/11 when you hear these people saying, well, you know, I went down the left stairwell instead of the right stairwell, and, you know, God saved me, and I got out of the building before it collapsed. Well, what about the people who did go to the right stairwell, and they're dead, and they have loved ones that are brokenhearted? What, God just didn't like them? Or, I mean, it doesn't seem fair if you're in that mode.
And I have a second question for you. Do you think with the space program now in late 2009, when the Planck satellite, for example, comes out with its data about the Big Bang, the origin and evolution of the universe, and it shows maybe through gravity waves that there might be infinite universes, the multiverse theory, meaning there was nothing that fine-tuned our universe for life. It's one of potentially infinite universes. Would that help to maybe bring about more atheists and agnostics and less believers?
Well, it certainly fills in a gap there for us. Although ultimately, you could still ask, well, where did the original material from the multiple universes come from? Unless you just want to postulate that there's an infinite number of them going back infinite amount of time, and that's, well, then we're at a bridge there, aren't we? We can't really cross, and there's not much more to say about it than that. I mean, the of course, the believer has the same problem of, well, then who created God? If you say, well, God does not need to be created, he's just an infinite being that always was, well, why can't there be multiple universes that were infinite and don't need, you know, creation? You know, at some point, you run into that epistemological barrier that you can't get past, and there we are.
At what point does science do so many wondrous things, Michael, where we, in just awe, look at some of the things that are happening?
Well, I think much of it is, I mean, the whole Hubble Space Telescope photographs of galaxies and the deep field photographs of huge clusters of galaxies, I think that's incredibly awe-inspiring. I mean, the idea of spirituality and sort of having a sense of awe and wonder and transcendence about something much grander than yourself, well, I think science does that in spades more than anything that religion does. Just in the awe and wonder of how small we are compared to the cosmos and how amazing it is that we're here. And that alone should give you pause. And, you know, the previous caller referenced, the forthcoming telescopes. It's only going to get better like that with bigger telescopes. And there's some huge ones going up in Chile and in Hawaii that are going to, you know, just blow the socks off of Hubble. It's just going to be amazing. And what's wrong with thinking of that as a way of transcendence and giving our species a sense of awe and wonder?
Let's go to West. Anonymous, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm in Eugene, Oregon. I had was born a Catholic, was baptized, confirmed, had Holy Communion. By the time I was 18, I was atheist. By the time I was 28, I was agnostic. Then when I was about 42, I had an epiphany, okay? Okay, I don't want to get into that. I want to go into something that happened after that, that was a series of synchronicity. You know what synchronicity is, right?
Yep.
Right?
Yes.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, so what happened was, I was driving down the street, and I was thinking about going to the dentist. I looked up, and I saw a dentist's office across the street, and the name was Latin, and it turned out the man was a Mexican. Okay, this was the beginning of it. That's the start, and there's a clue to what's going to happen. So then after I'd had the epiphany, I started going. This was in Hollywood, and I was going to a place called the Philosophical Research Society, run by Matt Hall.
Oh, yeah.
Hall.
Yeah, I've been there.
Okay. I went there for a year or 2 years, and I learned quite a bit of stuff, but I was deciding I wanted to go somewhere else. So this Friday came, and I got the impulse to go to Manly Halls, and I said, no, I want to go to this other place. And I fought this for Friday and Saturday, and I did not go, right? The next weekend, the same thing happened. I got this impulse on Friday to go, and I fought it, and I did not go. Sunday morning, I went, and I went instead of going into the auditorium, I sat down on a sofa in the vestibule of the auditorium. I'm sitting there, and I'm wondering what in the heck I'm doing there. I didn't want to be there. And while I'm sitting there, a woman walks over, starts talking to the doorman, and she mentions a psychic's name. As soon as she mentioned that psychic's name, I knew I had to see that psychic. Got up. This was on a Sunday morning. I got up, went over, asked her for the address and phone number of the psychic. She gave it to me gladly, and I left right then and drove clear across town to the address, and it was closed, okay? So that was on a Sunday. Monday, I called up, and I talked to a doctor. I won't give his name, but he's long gone now anyhow. And I talked to him, and I said, I'd like to hear his lectures. He says, well, I'm not going to be here. He says, I started my series of lectures last week. Now, you catch the connection here? The week that I felt this strong impulse to go, I had refused. Then I went the next week, and I got the impulse and went to his place. He said, I started my series of lectures. I've got six more to go. I said, fine. I want to hear him. I want to go to him. So I went, started going to the lectures, okay? Now we get to the last night of the lecture. And we go to the... At the end of the lecture, he says, all right, he says, now we're going to do a little ritual. And in this was in his house on the southeast corner of Beverly Hills, outside of the Beverly Hills city limits, but it was an old, nice house. And across the living room, which is where the classes were, it was like a walkway. And in the center of it was an alcove with a mirror. He said, okay, each of you, he says, anybody that wants to, anybody that don't want to, don't do it. But you come up here, sit down, and ask for information for your past lives. So different people went up there, and I, at this point, and most of the time since I've been into this, I am very reluctant and hang back when things like this. So I'm sitting there watching the people, watching the faces in the mirror. One woman I was watching, and she's looking into the mirror, and tears started rolling down her face, okay? So it came to the end, and I was the last one. I had held off to the last one. And at the last minute, I did it. I went up there and I got up, but I sat down in front of the mirror. And the ritual prior to my coming up there, the psychic had asked the cosmic forces.
I want to know what's your point, though. Where are we going with this?
We're going to get there right now. I said, can I use my own words? He says, yeah. I looked in the mirror and I said, I stated something that I won't say. And I sat there looking, and I'm looking and looking in the mirror, and I'm seeing nothing, and then the mirror starts to shimmer. And I looked into it, and I see myself, and I was shocked. And I was sitting there shocked, and the psychic who was standing by my shoulder said, did you see anything? And I said, no. And then he said, I saw something. And I turned to him, I said, to look to see what he said. He said, the Inquisition had you. They had pulled your tongue out of your mouth and nailed it to your chin. And that seems to be something that the Latins seem to do.
So you're a believer in reincarnation, I take it. But you're not, Michael Shermer.
Right. Well, we've all had experiences, not necessarily just like the one he told, but something unusual happens where there's a long train of events that preceded it that we recall with great detail, because they become pregnant with meaning because of the outcome. But think of all the just millions of things that happen in our lives that don't end up with any particular outcome like that. And yet it's all just stuff happening. And so our brains are picking out the ones that we remember as something kind of unusual and interesting, and the rest just are noise, background noise. And then we graft onto it things like what we've heard in movies we've seen or books we've read or shows like this we've listened to, and think, oh, okay, the explanation for that is demons or ghosts or aliens or reincarnation or whatever. And I think it's probably nothing more than that.
Let's talk about Bigfoot for just a moment here, Michael. We've never captured one, right? So we don't have one.
Right.
But so many people have seen some kind of a huge creature. I don't think you're calling them a liar. So what do you think they're seeing? What are they spotting out there?
Oh, there's a number of things that, you know, goes on when you're out on a hike somewhere. And, you know, some of them could be bears or, you know, stray dogs or who knows, cougar or something like this. You know, probably the bear thing is one explanation, or just, spooky things that go bump in the night. You know, when it's night and it's quieter and we can hear, you know, things. There's a lot of nocturnal animals that are out about at night and we're in our tent feeling kind of spooky anyway. And then you see, you poke your head out, you see a shadow, you hear a noise, whatever. No, I don't think they're lying. I think they're having experiences. The question is, what do the experiences represent? And, you know, it's a combination of our imagination and, you know, events in the environment that, you know, we can't really explain. And, again, it's that agenticity where we tend to infuse our patterns that we connect with some kind of agent behind it. It's, you know, it's a Bigfoot or whatever. Now, in the case of Bigfoot, it's not like an alien thing, which is so unlikely. The universe is so big and there's so much empty space between planets. Mm-hmm. It's not likely they've come here. Bigfoot, you know, hey, there could be a bipedal primate. There were a bunch.
Sure.
You know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, there were several hominids, bipedal hominids, living at the same time. So it could be. But it's just, we need a body.
We need a body. One day we may get it. I just hope they don't get it when somebody goes out and shoots it.
Yeah, well, if there's the last one, yeah, that would not be good. But that's happened. Tasmanian wolves.
Absolutely. Tell me a little bit about the Skeptic magazine. How do people subscribe to it, Michael?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. Yes, it's you can go to skeptic.com and subscribe. You go into any Barnes & Noble or Borders, you can pick up a copy. It's usually in the science section of magazines next to Scientific American, whom I also write for. And, so it's a science magazine primarily. It's not definitely not an atheism magazine. That subject comes up a lot because it's popular these days. But really, we also have Junior Skeptic magazine for kids, you know, teaching kids how to think critically. And, we put on a lecture series at Caltech, and we have conferences. So check out skeptic.com. That's the best place to do it.
All right. Well, you stay with us. Dr. Michael Shermer, our guest. And we'll be back in just a moment with final phone calls. And that means from Tennessee, state of Washington, Georgia, Kentucky, Texas, and the rest of North America right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, you can pick up the After Dark News magazine by dialing 1-888-727-5505. Just chock full of all kinds of great stories. After Dark, you can also go to coasttocoastam.com to pick it up as well. Next hour, Michael Horn joins us as we talk about some UFO cases. Up next, your final questions with Dr. Michael Shermer on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Michael Shermer and your phone calls as well. Michael, did you hear about the Branson Burt Rutan story today? It looks like they've got their Spaceship One built, and by 2011, they're going to start taking people out into space.
Yep, sign me up. If I had the money, I'd do it. I think it's terrific. Burt Rutan's he's an amazing guy. I love what they're doing there. He's one of those guys that if you want to predict the future, you know, the future's so hard to predict. If you want to predict the future, you just make the future.
And absolutely.
He's one of those guys that does that.
He sure does. It's a shame Stephen Fawcett's not with us anymore, though, huh?
Yep, another one of those adventure explorer genius types.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Lexington, Kentucky, east of the Rockies. Hey, Steve, you're on with Dr. Shermer. Go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Shermer. It's an honor to speak with you. I always enjoy when you're on with Coast to Coast, and I enjoy your magazine.
Thank you.
I just wanted to call up and just offer you some support tonight. I think you probably get a lot of calls of people disagreeing with you on here, but I really enjoy what you had to say, and I agree with a lot of it. And I think it's great that you're out there doing what you're doing and educating the public. And I think it's an important mission because it seems to me that we have so much noise, if you will, out there in our education system nowadays, and so many distractions that I think the basic science message just gets overwhelmed. And so I really enjoy what you're doing. I think it's very important. I was wondering, I guess it would be, what do you think that we need to do in our education system to improve teaching basic science and those critical thinking skills that seem to be so lacking now?
Yep, good question, and thank you for the comments and support. I think teaching not just science facts, but also how science works, that is, how to think like a scientist, which isn't really all that magical. It's just a process looking for evidence and finding ways to test different hypotheses. Think of the Mythbusters. I mean, they're doing science. They're testing hypotheses. Yes, they're blowing stuff up while they do it. That's cool. but, you know, it's just a way of, like, you know, is this true or is this not true? Well, let's run an experiment and try it and see if we can get an answer. Busted, not busted, or indetermined. And that's kind of how scientists work. And I think the more we can teach that, especially through fun and entertaining ways like the Mythbusters, then that's good.
Okay, thanks, Steve, for that. Next up, Clarksville, Georgia, Andrew on the wild card line. Hey, Andrew, go ahead.
Hey, Dr. George. I'm sure you get this question all the time, and I'll just be redundant with it. But I wonder if you might say God bless you when people sneeze or maybe.
Interesting. Do you say anything like that, Michael?
I don't say God bless you. I do say whatever I say, gazoon tight or bless you or something like that. I'm not fussy about that stuff. I mean, I celebrate Christmas and Thanksgiving and all the holidays, and you know, they're all great times, great excuses to get together with family and friends and have a good party and be thankful for everything. Why not? And exchanging gifts, what's cooler than that? So, you know, I like all that.
What'd you get me for Christmas, by the way?
I'm sending it to you telepathically. So
you know, once somebody sent me a fruitcake, and it had been half eaten about 6 years ago.
Oh, God.
I, of course, shared it with my staff, and they gobbled it up, no doubt, thinking I ate the other piece. But no,
oh, there
kidding.
You go.
But it was unbelievable. Norris Lake, Tennessee. Dennis on the wild card line. Go ahead, Dennis.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning. How are you, Denny?
I'm excellent. George, I've listened to the show for years, even with George, and I just want to say that this show tonight has been one of my favorite ones. Dr. Shermer, I can't believe you slipped under my radar. I think your logic is crystalline, and the ways you've explained to sort of get to the truth really work. And I'd like to hear your comment, and I'd like to make a recommendation very quickly. George,
go ahead.
If you could get Michael together with Linda Moulton Howe, I think that would be a really good one. Now, my question is, I'd like to hear Michael's take on crop circles.
Oh, well, I mean, don't we have lots and lots of videos of those being made? So we know how they're made. And the ones we don't have videos of being made that look like the ones that we have videos being made, the natural inference, of course, is that they're all made, as opposed to some of them are just made by people and the others are made by aliens, which is far less likely by a lot. So that's my take on crop circles. And who's this other person he was referencing?
Linda's our investigative reporter.
Oh, okay.
She's one of our reporting staff. Now, I'm going to set up a debate between you and Shoes and maybe Richard Hoagland, and I'll just keep them coming at you.
Yeah, get Dinesh D'Souza and me on there. He's a good debate partner. He's very sharp.
Let's go to Tony in Dallas, Texas. First time caller. Hey, Tony, go ahead.
Greetings, all. Dr. Shermer, I can appreciate a good skeptic as well as an ex-guy. I'm a member of that club. But in focusing on life after death, The fairness question aside for a moment, I heard the story about the young lady you referred to who was paralyzed. Let me turn the question around just a little bit and ask you, if you decided to believe in life after death, and it turns out at the end when the lights go out, it's just plant food and worm food, what then would you have lost, sir? Thank you.
Well, nothing, because I had nothing before I was born, so I'll have nothing after I'm gone. It's just my legacy, my family, my friends, memories. You know, it's just, that's it. I find that not in the least bit depressing, actually. It just doesn't bother me for some reason. I know that comes up a lot. People believe in God because they're afraid of dying or whatever. It's like, I don't know if that's really the case.
What do you think of the Bible, Michael? Just a storybook?
Well, of course, it's many books. You know, the Book of Psalms is not a storybook. That's a book of, you know, poetry and wisdom and so forth. And some of it's history, some of it's moral homilies. Many of the moral homilies of the Old Testament, of course, we've abandoned now. The death penalty for disobedient children and adultery. Well, there would go half of Congress, right? So, you know, we pretty much don't practice most Old Testament morality anymore. But why not? Why don't we? And the answer is because we move on. We solve moral dilemmas through reflective thought. And in a democracy, we often vote on these things if they're going to be put into law, like gay marriage or abortion or whatever. But certainly the hundreds of years ago, people justified with the Bible slavery. And these were good Christian, God-fearing men who justified it. And the one exception, William Wilberforce, who led the abolitionist movement in England, he stands out simply because he was one of the few Christians fighting against his fellow Christians who all held the Bible up and said, no, it's okay, it's in the book, waving the book at him. And, you know, he stood up and said, but no, we have to be misreading this because this can't be right to treat people like this. So something changes that's not biblical, it's not religion, it's something else, where our moral circle, our sphere of sentiments we want to offer to other people keeps growing, blacks, women, minorities, and so on, such that everybody becomes a member of the in-group. That's the place we're heading. And the Bible, the New Testament's a good start. It's a good improvement over the Old Testament in that regard. But I think we can do better still.
Okay, very good. Next up, we go to Olympia, Washington, where Tim is standing by. Go ahead, Tim.
Hey, guys. I have a question. Read in the New York Times about the hypothesis that we're living in a simulated reality and that computers really aren't that far off from being able to handle a simulation of, you know, the Earth, and maybe it's post-humans or aliens or someone else running the simulation for historic reasons, entertainment, just to learn data. Any thoughts, opinions?
I'm just pulling up a Douglas Adams quote here for you. Let's see if I can get this. There is a theory which states that if anyone ever discovers exactly what the universe is for and why it is here, it will instantly disappear and be replaced by something even more bizarre and inexplicable. There's another theory which states that this has already happened. Huh. I love that quote. Well, you know, if we did live in a virtual reality that was indistinguishable from real reality, whatever that is, then it wouldn't matter, would it? And in a way, that's what the resurrection is proposing, in a sense, that you'll be almost like a Star Trek thing where you're beamed up. When you die, your essence, your soul, whatever, will be beamed up to another place. Well, you will be reconstructed in this other reality that's just as real as this reality, but it's different. It's even better or whatever, if you go to the good place anyway. So, of course, we don't have the technology to do this, like a holodeck on Star Trek. But again, that's just a technological problem, isn't it? I mean, a super advanced alien technology could conceivably create holodecks. And in fact, that's one answer of the 50 or so answers to the question, where are they? How come they're not here? They should be out there. And one answer is the holodeck. They don't travel. They just create holodecks and sit inside their holodecks and travel that way in virtual reality. So it's a fun concept, but it's science fiction.
Think we'll ever get to time travel? Will it ever happen?
I tend to agree with Hawking on this, that if time travel were possible, we should be receiving visitors from the future. But we're not.
They
do.
They call this show.
They call the show. You're pretty funny, George. I like that. Yeah, okay, I'm convinced. I changed my mind. There you go. There's your headline. Shermer changes his mind about time travel because they're calling the George Noory show.
That's right. Don't forget, put it in your magazine. Green Valley, Arizona. Tony, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Tony.
I can't believe how skeptical some people are. Don't subscribe to all his views. But did somebody say something, if we were Neanderthal, we wouldn't be launching rockets or running radio stations?
Yeah, my argument there was that I don't think Neanderthal culture showed the kind of progress that Homo sapiens did to get to where we are. So we could, if we would have gone extinct instead of them, I don't think we'd be sitting here talking on the radio as Neanderthals.
Well, I think George is going to have to take back some things you said about Tom. I had a couple of quick points here. The first one being, you said something about we can't keep these big secrets or conspiracy because someone's always talking. But I see it as some of the biggest secrets they don't have to keep quiet because no one's going to believe them. We've been trained to set a ceiling on what we'll believe, and they don't have to keep them secret.
Maybe, except, you know, you do see periodically, like after the Bush administration was done, you know, even actually before the Bush administration was done, people that had left in the middle of the administration, they were all writing books and appearing on Larry King and doing all the talk shows and the lecture circuits talking about, you know, the inside story of what they saw and heard about the war and this and that. You know, really, people just can't keep their mouth shut. They just can't. So we do eventually find out about these secrets.
Okay, well, finally, you mentioned that you don't believe in God, of course, but I propose that you do have a God and it's your mind. And the way with a lot of scientific people is, if I can't wrap this 3 pounds of meat in my head around something, then it must not be true. So when I finish this call, I'm going to sit down and pray that something happens this week that will surpass your mind and go straight to your knower, and hopefully rekindle the passion you said you had as a young Christian.
Okay, well, cool.
There you go.
I hope it works. What should I be looking for?
Who knows? Do you want to believe, Michael? Do you want to believe?
Yeah, I kind of like the poster that Fox Mulder had on his office in X-Files, I want to believe.
Yeah.
I do, but I also want to know. And I'm old enough now and experienced enough to know that they aren't always the same. What I would like to be true is often not what I actually think is true. And so I'm also skeptical of myself much of the time. So
intuition, part of the human body, or given
I think intuition is a very real thing. I mean, psychologists call this thin slicing or rapid cognition. It's a famous book written by Malcolm Gladwell, Blink. But it, you know, it's real. We much of what goes on in our mind is subconscious. There's a lot of processing going on. The computer is whirring away there beneath our consciousness, processing all kinds of information that we're not consciously aware of, and yet we make decisions often based on that, which kind of feels subjective or intuitive. But we're actually processing information along the way. So intuition is a little bit of a fuzzy word. That's why psychologists don't use it. They like something like rapid cognition or subconscious cognition, something like that.
Let's go to Casey in Mesa, Arizona. Go ahead, Case. A few moments for you.
Hey, thanks. Hey, I just wanted to pick up that conversation about evolution. Now, dinosaurs were around, 200 million years? Evolving the whole time, you know, millions of species, but they never evolved big brains, right? And then all of a sudden the apes come along and poof, all of a sudden got big brains. Now,
all of a sudden. It is about 7 million years between the last common ancestor between us and chimpanzees, and that common ancestor had a pretty tiny brain. So it's about 7 million years. That's a long time, actually.
but But brains are kind of this multi-purpose thing. You know, evolution doesn't create mechanisms for future use. You know, it doesn't create a brain because someday, oh, you might want to build a space.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely right.
Giraffes evolve long necks because the branches are higher and they need to get the leaves off the tall trees. But it seems like, you know, we say we use 10% of our brain. Why do we have a brain that we only use 10% of?
Well, first of all, that's a myth. We do use our brains. We're probably only aware of about 10% of its use, but it's whirring away there. It's at work all the time. So that's a myth. But your deeper point, I think you're after there, is an important one, which is what would be the evolutionary adaptation to having a brain that can run computers? And the answer is none. You don't really need a brain that big. So it's a what's called an exaptation, sometimes a spandrel. You know, like the space between two arches in a church is called a spandrel. It doesn't serve any functional purpose at all. It's just the leftover space between two arches. And so artists fill it with decorative art. And much of our behavior, much of human anatomy and physiology and brain is a spandrel. There was no adaptive purpose for it, or it had some other purpose. So we need to be able to, you know, detect agency in predators, for example. But that also leads to belief in gods and ghosts and spirits and demons and angels and all that. Or the same processor that can create stone tools can also run computers. Well, how amazing is that? Pretty amazing. Without anybody designing it ahead of time to do that.
Absolutely. About a minute to go, Michael Shermer. I want to thank you again for being on the program. We'll set up the great debate again. Two go in,
sure,
one comes
out. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Now, you've
really
done that before.
I have, yep, and you're a great host. You're very fair and balanced. You're fair and balanced, and you're not on Fox. That's pretty good.
Well, that's pretty good.
No, I enjoy enjoy being on your show a lot.
Well, so, you know, Michael, I march to my own drum.
Yep, that's good. We should all do that. Got to be true to yourself.
That's the name of the game. You take care of yourself, and thanks for a fascinating interview. It's always
thanks,
fun
George.
To have you. All right, Dr. Michael Shermer. He's the editor and publisher of Skeptic Magazine. His websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. He's also got a book out called Science Fiction, Where the Known Meets the Unknown. The show's not over yet, though. Up next, Michael Horn with more information about some UFOs and some other predictions of the great Billy Meyer. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM.